himself to more. "It's got an interesting aftertaste, a hint of malt or spice or something." "We spice the beer with..." Boendal removed the tankard from his lips and held up a hand to quiet her.
"Don't," he said. "I'd rather not know if you'd flavored it with powdered maggot or caterpillar blood or vracus knows what. It tastes too good for you to spoil it."
He carried on drinking, and Mia said nothing, smiling to herself. Dessert was a pale, creamy dish that tasted a bit like honey. Tungdil found a husk in his bowl that looked suspiciously like the casing of a maggot, but he finished his serving and kept the discovery to himself. Boindil requested seconds, but this time he didn't inquire what went into the dish. Tired, sated, and slightly tipsy, they swayed up the stairs and tumbled into bed.
"I'm glad we came with you," murmured Boindil,
loosening his belt and letting out a big belch to make space in his belly.
"If we stay much longer, I won't fit into my male shirt. Mia's cooking tastes too good."
The other two laughed. "I'm glad you came as well," said Tungdil seriously. "I thought I might be travelling on my own."
"After all we've been through," exclaimed Boindil. "We'll always be here for you, especially if you insist on risking your life among outcasts and criminals. Someone has to watch your back."
"Outcasts and criminals," echoed Tungdil thoughtfully. "I haven't seen or heard anything to suggest that the Freelings are any less respectable than the other folks." Boindal yawned and crossed his arms behind his head.
"You seem to be forgetting that they were banished from their kingdoms, which means they or their parents or grandparents were guilty of a crime."
He gave Tungdil a hard look.
"The same goes for Mir."
"Mir saved your life," snapped Tungdil testily.
"I know, and I won't forget it. That's why Boindil has sworn to protect her. But it doesn't change who she is."
"That's not the only oath we've taken," said Tungdil, thinking of the vows of friendship pledged after the Battle of the Black Saddle. "We wanted a unified Girdlegard, and that means all men, elves and dwarves, the Freelings included. Gemmell spoke of 5 main cities, 5 cities the size of Trove Gold. We need to ally ourselves with the Freelings for the sake of Girdlegard and the security of our borders." He met Boendal's eye and held his gaze with dwarven tenacity. "It's our responsibility to find out more about them and their customs before we come to any decisions about whether our differences can be bridged." He paused, fixing the twins with a steely stare.
"To be honest, they seem a good deal more welcoming and forgiving than some dwarves I know."
Boindal looked up at the ceiling.
"Vracus will open our eyes to the truth," he said elliptically, settling down to sleep.
Sighing, Tungdil stared glumly into the darkness.
"I'd have more luck bending steel than changing a dwarven mind."
He was grateful to the twins for coming with him to Trove Gold, but he wished they were a little friendlier toward their hosts. Even Boendal, who was usually quite reasonable, seemed to have ruled out the possibility of forging a lasting bond with Gemmell's dwarves. "Why does it have to be so hard?" he thought wearily.
"What are we going to do about Keenfire?"
asked Boindil, breaking the silence.
"You're not going to let the Hollow Eyes keep her, are you?"
"Why don't you ask Glaimbar?" said Tungdil snidely. He closed his eyes.
"I'll get the axe back. We don't need it right now, and it won't be much use to the Alfar. But I won't delay too long. Keenfire belongs with the dwarves."
"Hurrah!"
cheered Boindil, sensing a new adventure.
"You can count me in."
Kingdom of John Balsur, Girdlegard, Early Summer, 6235th Solar Cycle. Ondori breathed in the smoke, billowing over her homeland, and shuddered. remembering the red-hot flames that had burned her face. The struggle for keen fire had left her horribly disfigured and given her another reason to wear a mask. From her vantage point in the watchtower, originally constructed by the elves of the Golden Plains, she gazed at the thick bank of smoke in the south. John Balseur was on the brink of defeat. Firebombs rained into the dense woodland from allied mangonels, spilling petrol, oil, pitch and sulphur, and setting light to everything, including the silicified wood of the fossilized trees. Already the allies had burned a wide path through the forest toward the Bone Palace. They were a fair few miles from John Balseur, but the remaining distance consisted largely of flat, open land. Ondori turned to face the capital. Midway between John Balseur and the forest lay the stronghold of Arvieux, from whence reinforcements were marching toward the front. Soon every last elf would be fighting for the kingdom. She ran a hand over her quarterstaff.
"We'll make the allies pay for their victory," she vowed. "They've had enough of our arrows. Let's see how they like our staffs."
She left the tower and descended the 50 paces to the ground. Every step was slow and considered, her movements hampered by the damage inflicted by Tungdil's dagger. The pain was a constant, humiliating reminder of her disastrous mission to secure the Groundling's kingdom. She had failed on all counts. The Groundlings were ensconced in their stronghold. Her parents' murderers were still alive, and she had failed to learn the secret of the Orc's unnatural power. Forced to flee the battlefield, she had stopped only to snatch up a drinking pouch, knowing that wasted hours looking for streams or rivers could lead to capture or death. It was only much later, when she uncorked the pouch, that she realized her mistake. The water was stagnant, brackish, and unpalatable, but she drank it all the same. The immortal siblings, after hearing how the 5,000-strong orcish army had been defeated by a handful of dwarfs, had banished her to the front, where she was to die in defense of her kingdom. To her relief, the siblings had confiscated Keenfire. She never wanted to touch the accursed weapon again. Ondori was content with her fate. Death would come as a release, the last chance of heroism at the end of life of abject failure.
"Although I can't avenge my parents when I'm dead," she thought bitterly,
at least the immortal siblings had granted her a final favor. 100 warriors, all failures like herself, were at her command. She emerged from the base of the tower and swung herself onto her fireball. Her eyes wandered over the waiting group of Alfar, warriors of both sexes whose courage had been found wanting.
"Listen to me, weak-hearted warriors," she said harshly. "I'm taking you behind enemy lines. Your mission is to kill 10 elves, dwarves, or humans before you die. Anyone who flees the battle will be chased by my arrows or Agrus's horns."
She patted the thick black neck of the fireball.
"Acquit yourselves well. Teon's judgment awaits you when you get to the other side, and eternal agony is the price of failure. Those who prove themselves worthy will receive the blessing of the immortal siblings, the mark of which I bear."
She nodded to the warrior at the head of the procession, and the troop set off on a southerly bearing. Ondori rode at the back, keeping a careful watch for defectors. It took less than an orbit to reach the forest, where the allies' firebombs were whizzing through the trees.
"Another mile, and they'll be marching across the plains," she thought dismally.
She had foreseen the fall of John Balseur from the watchtower, but the reality of the situation came as a shock. The allies were closer to victory than she had thought. A warrior in black armor emerged from the trees.
The immortal siblings want you to destroy the Manganels and kill those responsible for the bombardment, he told her tersely. His manner indicated all too plainly that he considered her unworthy of respect. He handed her a scroll, detailing the strategy for the attack. My band will distract them while you and your troop set light to the oil drums. We'll figure out the rest from there. His gaze rested on her mask. Are you too ugly to show yourself? He demanded, reaching out to tear off her mask and veil. Agras let out a belligerent snort and turned his head so that his left horn grazed the warrior's chest. The elf paled and took a step back. It's a pity you're a coward, Onduri told him coldly. If you were to see my face, you'd know. She trailed off, remembering that Keenfire had stolen her looks. That I'm ready to die, she finished lamely. No one's stopping you, he hissed, disappearing among the trees. After relaying her orders to the troop, she led them in a westerly direction, looking for a safe route into the forest, where they wouldn't be spotted by enemy guards. 4 miles later, they found a suitable place and rested until midnight, before stealing their way toward the camp. Onduri stopped and cursed. She and her troop were perfectly placed to attack, but the camp was guarded by a battalion of groundlings and elves. There was a constant screeching and groaning as windlasses turned, tightening the ropes to pull back the wooden catapults. Dripping pouches were placed in the metal cups at the end of each arm, and the contents set alight with a burning torch, whereupon the arms were released, and a hail of fiery missiles hissed through the night and crashed among the trees. The burning petroleum turned the forest into a sea of twisting flames. Tion wants us to die gloriously, she whispered to the others. See the groundlings and the tree-loving fairies? Their destruction is our salvation. She gripped her quarterstaff and held it aloft like a lance. Prepare for the attack, and don't forget, I'll be watching you. Desertion is punishable by death. A few moments later, they heard shouts from the other side of the encampment. Horns sounded the alarm, warning the dwarves and the elves of an elvish incursion. The diversionary tactic seemed to work. Now, she said loudly, and her warriors rushed forward, keeping low to the ground. In the darkness, they were all but invisible, and their boots moved noiselessly across the forest floor. The elves and dwarfs, expecting an attack on the opposite flank, were taken by surprise. Onduri waited until all her warriors were engaged in combat. When she was sure that no one had slipped into the undergrowth, she left her hiding place and threw herself into the scrum. The elves had no chance to use their bows and were forced into close combat. Dwarves rushed to their aid and surrounded their hated enemies, swinging their axes and hammers with grim determination. Onduri's heart sank as she watched the elves and dwarves close ranks to ward off the invaders. Soon, dwarven axes were slashing at the Alfar from behind a wall of shields. The elves lined up in rows behind them, ready with their spears. The Alfar came to a standstill, 300 paces from the barrels of oil.
What's the matter with you?
Onduri shouted angrily, stabbing her quarterstaff into the back of a retreating elf.
Don't let up!
Just then a dwarf cried out in agony and sank to his knees, breaking the wall of shields. The tip of an elven spear protruded from his chest.
Did you say that? Shouted a dwarven voice. The pointy-eared villain stabbed him in the back!
There was an almighty crash, and an elf slumped to the ground, felled by a ferocious blow from a morning star.
Children of the smith! The pointy ears have betrayed our vows of friendship, howled the dwarf, voice cracking with grief and rage. Death to the traitors!
Onduri heard an elven curse, and a moment later, an arrow sang through the air and came to rest in a dwarven skull.
The sturdy warrior's face was frozen in astonishment as he fell to the ground. An elf sprawled on top of him, a dwarven axe in his back. 2 dozen dwarves turned as one and advanced toward their supposed allies, who raised their weapons to block the attack. At first, the elves parried and checked the dwarven axes, but soon both sides were locked in combat. Onduri could hardly believe her luck.
The dwarves and elves need more than a promise of friendship to bridge an age-old rift.
She bellowed at her warriors to resume the attack, and the Alfar surged forward, finding the gaps in the allies' defenses and slaughtering elves and dwarves alike. Onduri, trusting in Teon to watch over her warriors, left the battlefield and rode toward the undefended encampment. The men loading the mangonels stared at her in horror as she galloped past and seized a burning torch from the hand of a guard. Lowering his head, Agras charged into the pile of oil barrels, destroying them with his horns. The burning torch landed in the middle of the spillage, turning the foul-smelling oil into a fiery lake. More barrels exploded, further fueling the flames. Onduri didn't stop to watch. She was busy cutting down the men at the mangonels, none of whom were trained warriors. They put up little resistance to Onduri and her fireball, and their deaths were painful, but swift. With one exception. Unbeknown to Onduri, one of the men had escaped the bloodbath and sheltered behind a mangonel's wheel. He waited until she rode past, then hurled his spear, hitting her in the back. The tip pierced her heart. Onduri gasped, fighting for breath as she wrenched the weapon from her chest. Slumped in her saddle, she listened to the man's receding footsteps and waited for death to take her soul. After a while, the pain in her chest subsided, and she was able to sit up. She raised a hand to the exit wound and ran her fingers over the flesh. The wound had closed.
"I'm not dead," she realized in amazement. "Teon has made me immortal like the orcs."
In a flash of understanding, she remembered how she had drunk of the orcs' foul water.
"Teon be praised," she thought,
resolving to tell the immortal siblings of her discovery. But first, she would carry out her orders and destroy the mangonels. Steering Agras to the edge of the blaze, she lowered her quarterstaff and dragged it across the ground to the mangonels, cutting a furrow through the forest floor. A river of burning liquid flowed toward the wooden siege engines. Soon flames were licking at the timber and creeping hungrily along the ropes.
"My work isn't finished," she thought proudly, pressing gently against the fireball's flanks and cantering back to the battle. "Let's find more elvish souls for Teon to torture."
Roaring, Agras charged through the enemy lines, tossing elves and dwarves into the air like rag dolls. His powerful metal-sheathed horns pierced everything they encountered, shields, armor, and guts. Shaking his head furiously, he sank his pointed teeth into his victims' torsos, ripping out chunks of leather, metal, and flesh. To Onduri's astonishment, she and her warriors triumphed over the battalion of elves and dwarves.
"They brought it on themselves," she thought gleefully,
remembering how the allies had turned on each other. She touched the mark on her forehead.
"Teon is with me."
The flames from the burning mangonels were clearly visible throughout the forest by the time the survivors alerted their allies to their plight. But the humans came too late. Elves and dwarves lay dead or dying on the battlefield, and, on seeing the new arrivals, the remaining Alfar slipped into the forest and disappeared among the gloomy boughs. Arrows and crossbow bolts whizzed past them, missing their targets. A few paces away from the clearing, Onduri stopped and looked in satisfaction at the inferno raging in the enemy camp. Agras snorted and swung his head to the left.
"A fugitive?" she asked.
The fireball raked a metal-plated hoof against the ground.
Who could it be? She wondered. An elf for Teon to torture? Or a deserter who deserves my wrath?
The bull slunk through the trees. In the faint moonlight, Onduri spotted four squat figures running through the undergrowth.
Groundlings, she thought, surprised. It's not often you see them running from a fight.
A moment later, she was upon them. Hearing Agras's hooves, they turned to face her, weapons raised.
Clear off, and we'll spare you,
growled their leader from behind a metal visor. He gave his morning star a menacing swing.
Spare me?
She spat scornfully. Just then she realized that one of them was holding a bow. The string snapped back, and she dodged the arrow which buried itself in a tree.
A fairy bow?
She exclaimed, confused.
What would a groundling want with a...
Her eyes widened.
A morning star and a fairy bow. It was you. You started the quarrel on purpose.
She peered at the band.
Who are you?
I said clear off, snapped their leader. We're stronger than you and we're not afraid to prove it.
Onduri was tempted to put the matter to the test, but an angry mob of humans, emboldened by fury, had summoned the courage to pursue her through the trees. She could tell from the clunking armor, raised voices and flickering torches that the men were approaching fast.
Are you thirdlings? She asked sharply. Why don't you send an envoy to John Balsur? Together we could defeat our common foe.
Clear off or die,
their leader threatened. Onduri decided that it wasn't the time or the place to risk her life against four groundlings. Her failure at the Black Saddle had been redeemed in part by her success on the battlefield, and a foolhardy skirmish with a band of groundlings would do little to improve her stock. Tugging on the reins, she turned and rode off to find the rest of her band, leaving the four dwarves behind her.
Nagsor and Nagsar will welcome the news of the groundlings' rift.
The thirdlings' intervention, though unexpected, was welcome. Onduri had no idea what they were plotting, but it was bound to mean trouble for the other dwarven folks.
We'll have to keep an eye on them, she decided. With luck, the children of Inaste will profit from their game.
Perista, former realm of Leos Nudin, Girdlegard, autumn 6235th solar cycle. We can't wait forever, estimable Mega, said Narmora, looking up from her reading. Wasn't Jerun supposed to be home by now? I thought you told him to be back within 80 orbits. The fair-haired Mega nodded wearily. They were sitting opposite each other in the library, Andakai with her right elbow propped on the armrest of her easy chair. She rested her forehead on her palm, feeling the weight of the thoughts that had been troubling her since Weyern. He's been gone 132 orbits, she murmured. It isn't like Jerun to be late. Something must be stopping him. She stood up fretfully. I'd understand if he were an ordinary warrior, but Jerun is... He's the king of Teon's creation, finished Narmora. I know the legend. The son of Samusin, my people call him. He keeps order among Teon's beasts, destroying the weak and hunting the cowardly. I keep forgetting your mother was an elf. In that case, I'm sure you understand that whatever is keeping him must be tremendously powerful. Where did you find him? I saved him from a band of men. I couldn't bear the thought of a magnificent creature like Jerun dying at the hands of fame-seekers and glory-hunters, so I rescued him, and he became my bodyguard. Over 100 cycles have passed since then. She snorted angrily, snatched up a candlestick and hurled it against the shelves.
To blazes with it all! We'll never find out what's happening in the Outer Lands.
Didn't Weyern's warriors have anything to report? Inquired Namora.
eager to learn the contents of the Magus' correspondence. Andukai smiled wryly.
They've disappeared, as I said they would.
She took a scroll of parchment from the folds of her crimson robe.
According to Queen Zamtis, they left via the Red Range and haven't been heard of since. Her sentries are on the lookout for survivors, but it doesn't look good.
Zamtis thinks the fire is spreading in the outer lands. There's a bright red glow across the border, and it's getting closer all the time. She pointed to the rows of books.
The combined wisdom of Gerdlegard scholars, and what does it tell us?
Nothing. She paced to and fro, stopping behind Namora.
You've worked hard, she said,
resting her hands on the half-elf's shoulders.
I wouldn't have thought it possible that a student could make such progress.
We might be strong enough to fight the Avatars after all.
We don't know for sure that the Avatars are to blame for the fire in the Outer Lands.
Namora took the letter from the Maga and read it, uninvited. She said thoughtfully. Queen Zamtis says no one is crossing into Gerdlegard from the west. She thinks something must be stopping traders and beasts from leaving the Outer Lands.
Which confirms our theory that the Avatars are getting closer, said Andukai, straightening up and returning to her chair.
Relieved that the Maga was no longer standing over her, Namora gave herself a little shake. She could feel the imprint of Andukai's hands on her shoulders, red with the blood of Fergus and her son. The Maga pulled out a sheet of parchment and inked her quill.
I hope to Samusin that Jerun is still alive, but I can't delay any longer. If we don't hold the meeting now, the dwarves, elves and men won't arrive before winter, and they're bound to get stuck in the snow.
They'll come as soon as they can, Namora assured her. There's plenty to discuss. According to reports, cracks were appearing in the Great Alliance. News had reached Perista of a dispute that had arisen between the elves and dwarves during a battle in Jon Balsur. Both sides were refusing to take arms against the Alfar until the other apologized, but neither was prepared to accept the blame. The destruction of the siege engines was a further obstacle to the Allies' progress, granting the Alfar a dangerous reprieve. Namora recalled the rumours about King Bellatane's army.
We'll have to ask the King of Urgon why his warriors are marching north.
There's speculation that he means to attack the Forthlings, but he's probably after the trolls.
Isn't his physician a dwarf?
Bellatane is a cretinous cripple, pronounced Andukai, lowering her quill. He took over from his nephew Lothair, whom the people loved and admired. Bellatane has profited from his nephew's popularity, although it's more a case of pity than respect. A mad king and an adoring populace, it's a dangerous mix.
If you don't mind, I need to check on Dorsa, said Namora, straightening up and striding to the door.
I'll be back in time for my lesson. She left the library and hurried through the empty corridors of the palace.
Dorsa was tucked up in her cot.
For a moment, Namora feared that the weight of the blankets had crushed her little chest, which was ridiculous, of course. The little girl was sleeping peacefully, tiny arms beside her head. Her breathing was calm and regular, which set Namora's mind at ease.
How you've grown, she whispered, stroking the baby's downy head.
Her daughter was an endless source of comfort, proof that everything would be all right. A single smile from Dorsa was enough to banish all her doubts. Namora could gaze forever at her sweet dimpled cheeks and tiny mouth, but sometimes another face would haunt her, the face of a tiny, lifeless baby mouldering under a pile of stones. She stooped down to kiss the pointy tip of her daughter's left ear. Dorsa smiled in her sleep.
Sleep well, my darling, she whispered softly. Your brother's death will be avenged.
She left the nursery on tiptoe and crossed the corridor to Fergus's room. Hearing the door open, Rodario leapt to his feet, dagger in hand.
Oh, it's you,
he said shamefacedly. His forehead was lined with creases from the sheets, indicating that he had been asleep. Honestly, Rodario, she said briskly, what would the Maga think if she found you in the palace with a dagger? You'll have to do better than this. I'm relying on your talents as an actor. She paused to kiss Fergus and caress his pale cheeks. Andakai has called a meeting about the avatars, she continued. Rodario sat up straight and ran a hand over his pointed beard. Listen, Namora, do you really mean to kill her? She glared at him angrily, so he hastened to elaborate. She's our only Maga, he said diplomatically, trying not to rile her. It won't make you any friends. No one will know it was me, she said confidently, wetting a cloth and squeezing it gently over Fergus's cracked lips. Andukai has taught me well. I know how to cover my tracks. Said Rodario, unconvinced. He took a moment to find the right words. The problem is this. If you avenge yourself on the Maga, Gerdlegard will be at risk. How are we supposed to defend ourselves if, or more likely when, we're attacked? She looked at him sadly. What's wrong with you, Rodario? You're shielding the woman who tried to kill your closest friend. Andokai never intended to kill him, just to put him in a coma. He slumped into his chair. Sometimes I think I shouldn't have told you, he said, sighing melodramatically. I don't wish to incur your fury, myopic angel of death, but Andokai is our one and only Maga. Aren't you forgetting me? You, said Rodario incredulously. I don't doubt you're a fast learner, but you're hardly Andokai the Tempestuous. He shook his head. You're not ready, Namora. Wait a few more cycles until your studies are complete. You might feel differently then. I didn't realize you were an authority on magic, she sneered. My son is dead. Fergus is in a coma. And their suffering will be avenged. She nodded to the door. Goodbye, Rodario. And thank you for looking after Fergus. I hope you enjoyed the sleep. Spare me your barbs, and think of Gerdlegard. Some of us are relying on the Maga to save us from our foes. He stepped smartly into the corridor and closed the door. Namora sat down beside Fergus. Slipping her right hand into her bodice, she felt for the gemstone hanging from her neck. She had been wearing the pendant since the Battle of the Black Saddle. If only Rodario knew my power. Still clasping the gemstone with her right hand, she placed her left hand on Fergus and ran her fingers over his stab wounds. As she closed her eyes, a green glow suffused his bandages, permeating the fabric and irradiating the flesh below. The glow intensified, shining brightly over the infected flesh and leaving healthy pink skin that grew back over the wound, leaving no sign of inflammation or scarring. Namora took a deep breath. It was beyond her means to revive her husband from his coma, but she knew how to heal his wounds. She left the bandages in place so that the Maga wouldn't notice. Thank you, she whispered gratefully, letting go of the stone. Our time will come. You'll see. She hurried away to resume her schooling. The transition was practiced and flawless. With every step toward the library, Namora became the obedient student whom the Maga had come to trust. Trove Gold, Underground Network, Kingdom of Goregar, Autumn, 6235th Solar Cycle. Tungdil was sitting cross-legged on Mir's roof, sipping a tankard of beer and looking down at the statue of Vrakus. Another busy and inspiring orbit was drawing to a close. Since arriving in Trovegold, Tungdil had experienced all manner of new things, and he was looking forward to seeing more. He used the pre-dinner lull to sip his beer and review what he had learned about the underground realm. As Mir had predicted, the king had insisted on guiding Tungdil and the twins through every street and alleyway in Trovegold to show them the richness of freeling life. They had visited allotments, workshops and smithies, and walked the length of the irrigation system, which was fed by a pair of waterfalls. Since then, they had made the acquaintance of numerous freelings, some new to Trovegold, others born in the city, but all unstinting in their praise of Gemmell's realm. Tungdil had searched their faces for signs of melancholy or sadness, but almost everyone seemed genuinely content. He could see why they were drawn to Trovegold, which was more than could be said for the twins. Boindal and Boindil were looking forward to returning to the Fifthling Kingdom with its familiar customs and laws. He heard heavy footsteps behind him. Jangling chainmail identified the visitor as one of the twins. Unlike Tungdil, they insisted on wearing armor wherever they went.
"You're thinking of staying, aren't you?"
said Boindal, sitting down next to him and putting his tankard on the floor. Tungdil sighed. "Is it that obvious?" His friend chuckled.
"Even my brother has started to realize that you might not come home. For him, well, for us, really, staying isn't an option."
He threw up his hands.
"Yes, I know we're all hewn from the same rock," he said, preempting Tungdil's objections. "But the freelings are outcasts."
He paused to take a glug of beer.
"Outcasts and thirdlings," he added in a muted but truculent voice. "I'm sorry, Tungdil, but it isn't a place for upstanding dwarfs."
"You're impatient to leave, I know," said Tungdil, refusing to enter into a discussion about outcasts and thirdlings, a category to which he belonged. "Your brother's inner furnace is overheating. He won't be happy until he's worked off his temper on a couple of orcs. He can't hunt Guggul forever." Boindal grinned.
"He's been catching them with his hands. You wouldn't want to be bitten by a Guggul. Their teeth are pretty sharp. The other hunters respect him even though they think he's mad."
He raised his tankard to the statue.
"Here's to Vrakas for steering our path to Trovegold. I'm glad we've seen a freeling city, but Boindil and I want to leave."
He looked at Tungdil intently.
"The sooner, the better," he said firmly. "We're worried."
"You mean about the dispute with the elves? It shouldn't have happened, I agree. Broken trust is difficult to repair, but I'm sure they'll find a way. It might delay the conquest of John Balsur by a cycle, but we'll triumph in the end. The Alfar are surrounded. There's nowhere for them to go."
"What?" exclaimed Boindal, astonished. "Don't you want to be out there fighting with them? Think what a difference it would make if the hero of the Black Saddle were to lead an army of dwarves against the Alfar. You could make peace with the elves, win back Keenfire and..."
"Confounded Glaimbar," cut in Tungdil irritably. "I wouldn't have lost the axe again if it weren't for him. To think the King of the Fifthlings couldn't defend himself against a wounded orc. I don't know how you expect me to get it back. The elf could be anywhere by now." He didn't like to be reminded about Keenfire, and he wished the others would stop mentioning it all the time. Boindal looked at him thoughtfully.
"Anyone would think you were ready to spend the rest of your life telling stories about the battles you fought in the good old cycles when you were a hero. You're not old yet, Tungdil. What about the future?"
Tungdil swallowed his irritation. "I've done my bit for Gerdlegard," he said calmly. "From now on, I want to be a regular dwarf who does regular things. I don't intend to sit by the fire. I'd like to work in a forge or find a way of using my knowledge."
"Like Mir, you mean? Is that what's keeping you here? Nothing kills the spirit of adventure like a maiden, they say."
Tungdil took a deep breath.
I don't know, he said, sadly. Mir isn't a bit like Belindis. We talk for hours and hours about books and ideas. I couldn't have that kind of conversation with Belindis. She isn't scholarly at all. But it's her I dream about, not Mir.
He looked his friend in the eye. What if I do something awful to drive Belindis and Glaimbar apart?
I don't want to be a schemer or murderer like Bislipur and the other Thirdlings. I'm scared of hurting Glaimbar and becoming just like them.
He emptied his tankard and set it down with a thud. I need to forget about Belindis so I can stop hating Glaimbar. I think it's better for everyone if I stay here with Mir. His friend nodded sympathetically.
Very well, scholar. If you're sure, but I can't promise that Boindil won't try to abduct you.
He and Tungdil laughed briefly, but their hearts weren't in it.
What if Gerdlegard were in trouble? Asked Boindil. Would you come if I asked you to?
Of course, said Tungdil simply, but I can't see it happening. When will you leave?
Tomorrow morning, before sunrise. Andalkai has summoned the leaders of Gerdlegard to a meeting in Perista.
He produced a roll of parchment.
According to Glaimbar, you, me, and Boindil have been chosen for the High King's entourage.
I'm sure Gundagar will manage with you and Boindil, said Tungdil emphatically.
What's the meeting about?
Boindil shrugged.
No one knows. It's confidential, apparently. But the Maegar probably wants to haul everyone over the coals. To be honest, I don't blame her. We pledged an oath of friendship and now we're killing each other.
He laid a hand on his friend's shoulder.
Farewell, Tungdil Goldhand. May Vrakas bless you and bring peace to your soul. I hope you live happily in Trovgold.
They stood up and clasped each other affectionately.
I'm not looking forward to telling my brother,
Boindil said gloomily.
Maybe Mir should sprinkle some herbs on his dinner to calm him down.
It's all right, I'll tell him myself, promised Tungdil.
They went downstairs to the kitchen and found Boindil at Mir's shoulder, watching hungrily as she prepared the meal. Two guggle were laid out on the kitchen table, gutted and ready to cook.
Caught with my own fair hands, he said, beaming.
He rolled back his sleeves for his scratches to be admired.
I didn't use axes, just wrung their necks. I tried telling myself they were orcs to make it more exciting, but it didn't really work.
He saw their glum expressions.
What's wrong? No bubbles in your beer?
You and Boindil are leaving tomorrow, said Tungdil simply. I'm staying because... Boindil frowned, lowering his head and squaring his shoulders aggressively.
I'll knock you down and drag you away if I have to. This had better be a joke.
No, I'm staying in Trovgold, began Tungdil. For the time being, at least, he continued, alarmed by the look on Boindil's face. I'm hoping to persuade Gemmell to send Freeling troops to John Balsur. I can't ask for his help and run away.
Boindil harumphed and crossed his arms belligerently.
Why not? Maybe I should talk to him.
Not on your life, laughed Tungdil.
Although your natural charm would probably settle a matter quickly.
Especially with a bit of help from your axes, added Boindil with a smile. Come on, brother, leave the negotiations to our scholar. Gundagard needs us in Perista.
Boindil strode up to Tungdil and smothered him with a hug.
Look after yourself, and don't keep me waiting.
I won't,
promised Tungdil half-heartedly. He glanced at Boindil, who was staring fixedly at the disemboweled guggle. He was obviously uncomfortable with the charade. Mir, guessing that the others were keeping something from Boindil, couldn't help smiling at the thought of having Tungdil to herself.
I'll cook a proper feast tonight,
she promised. The twins will need plenty of energy for the journey. She tied an apron around her waist. Maybe Gemmel will let you use the tunnels to save a bit of time. I can ask him if you like. Boindil grabbed the beetles by the tail and lowered them into the vat of bubbling broth.
Not until we've eaten, he ruled.
Chapter 2 Trove Gold, Underground Network, Kingdom of Goragar, Autumn 6235th Solar Cycle. Tungdil got up the next morning to find two empty beds. His friends had left without waking him. Mir was waiting with a special breakfast to fuel his inner furnace. Pancakes with cranberry syrup, warm guggle, and a variety of smoked meats. You just missed them, she said when he asked about the twins. They had breakfast, packed some provisions, and that was that. She sat down beside him and watched him eat. In the end, she couldn't help herself. A question was burning a hole in her soul. You've decided to stay in Trovegold, haven't you? You told Boindel you'd catch up with them later because you didn't want to cause a scene. Yes, Mia. I've decided to stay. He searched her inscrutable red eyes. I'd like to stay with you, if I may. Have you reached a decision? She asked eagerly. Do you want me to heal your heart? He gazed at her beautiful face, the silvery down on her cheeks, and her plump lips. She wants me to kiss her, he realized. I need more time. He jumped to his feet, seized with a sudden urge to leave the house. His brusqueness took him by surprise. I'm going to the allotments. I've been thinking of ways to improve the irrigation. Stopping briefly to kiss her forehead, he hurried from the room. You idiot, he cursed himself. He wished he were a proper dwarf who could fall in love with the maiden selected by his clan. I'd be a lot happier, he thought dismally. Belindis is happy, isn't she? He took the path leading to the waterfalls, visible from the other side of town. He watched them cascade into the basin, garlanded with spray. Droplets of water splashed against the surrounding rocks. On reaching the sluice system that regulated the flow to the canals, he spotted Sander Flameheart, Gemmel's companion, and commander-in-chief of the Freeling army. Sander was talking to the dwarves in charge of monitoring the water level and adjusting the sluice. Tungdil stopped for a moment. The king's muscular consort finished briefing the workers and turned to leave, but noticing Tungdil, raised a hand in greeting and hurried up the hill to meet him. The menacing tattoos on her forehead were unmistakable proof of her dwarf-killing past. Not even her billowing fair hair could soften the menace of the runes.
May Vrakas keep the flames of your furnace burning, she greeted him warmly.
She didn't seem the least out of breath, despite marching uphill in a leather bodice, plated mail, and a skirt-like arrangement of metal tassets that reached almost as far as her ankles.
Vrakas be with you, he replied. Are you going to battle? I thought no one wore armor in Trovegold.
She smiled, but the overall effect was more menacing than cheering.
I'm a warrior, Tungdil. I don't feel comfortable without my mail. I'm sure your friends felt the same. Besides, Trovegold isn't as safe as sweet little Mir would have you believe. Cave trolls and Bognilim have a habit of getting caught in the tunnels. She laid a hand on her axe. Thanks to my warriors, they never pass our gates.
He noticed that her downy cheeks were streaked with grey, indicating that she was older than he had thought.
You haven't lived here long, have you? Just over 2 cycles. It's no big secret.
She looked at him shrewdly.
You don't know what to make of me, do you? You and I are both thirdlings, but we've chosen not to kill our own kind. I never killed a dwarf in my life. I have, she said frankly, but I didn't much enjoy it. I was a dwarf killer because I grew up with dwarf killers, and killing was all I knew. Deep down, I knew it wasn't right. She sat down on the soft carpet of moss and gazed at the city. Tungdil sat beside her. In the end, I had to make a choice. So you chose banishment. I chose death. If my clansfolk were to find me, they'd kill me on the spot. I used to be a high-ranking warrior, as you can probably tell from my tattoos. But I forfeited the respect of the Thirdlings. In their eyes, I'm the enemy. Another dwarf for them to kill. She gazed up at the stronghold. Trovegold is my home now. I found someone who is willing to take me for who I am. Starting over is the hardest thing I've ever done. But I've made a new life with the Freelings. She turned to Tungdil. You wanted to ask me about your parents. What were their names? I don't know, he said with a shake of the head. I was a baby when my foster father, Lot Ionan, brought me from some kobolds who came knocking one night at his school. I can't remember a thing about my parents. I didn't realize I was a Thirdling until the Battle of the Black Sannel. She looked up sharply. How old are you? 60 cycles, maybe more, I'm not sure. Why do you ask? Sander was staring at him intently. I've been trying to figure out why your face looks familiar. You look exactly like her. She turned away, eyes fixed on the city. 60 cycles ago, something happened that made me leave my clansfolk and flee the Fifthling Kingdom. It hardly seems possible, but... Her gaze lifted to the statue of Rakus. It's the will of the smith, she whispered gratefully. My decision saved Gerdlegard. All my suffering wasn't in vain. Tungdil laid a hand on her shoulder. What is it, Sander? Do you know my parents? He asked, heart beating wildly. She laid her hand over his and looked at him tenderly. I knew your father, Tungdil. His name was Lotrebur, and your mother was Yerdis. They called you Kalungor. Yerdis was promised to another, and her love for Lotrebur was born of an ill-fated flame. But their feelings were too strong to ignore. You were born in secret. Your father tried to smuggle you out of the kingdom because he knew Yerdis's guardian would kill you if he could. She took a deep breath. I followed Lotrebur through the tunnels. My orders were to kill father and son. Did you? No. I caught up with him. We fought, and I won. Her eyes glazed over as her mind travelled back to the past, and the events of 60 cycles ago came to life. I raised my axe, she continued, tapping her weapons belt. I was going to cleave his skull with this very blade, but I heard you crying. It was a pitiful whimpering, but it softened my resolve. I looked into your father's eyes and decided that I never wanted to kill another dwarf. It was then I realized that I'd never been a proper dwarf killer. She lowered her eyes and stroked her weapon. So I helped him up and told him to hurry. Tungdil said nothing, waiting for her to continue. When I got back, I told them that Lotrebur had run away. That was when they showed me the corpses. Your mother's body and your father's head. I wasn't the only one who'd been ordered to kill them. Yerdis's guardian, your great-uncle, had murdered them and thrown you into a chasm. Vrakus couldn't save your parents, but he let you live because he knew a glorious future lay ahead of you. He shaped your fate and led you to the Magus. She smiled at him fondly. And now he's brought us together, 60 cycles later. Tungdil swallowed. What was my great-uncle called? Salfalor Shieldbreaker, King Lorimbor's right-hand dwarf. He's still alive, as far as I know. Your father was his best friend, which is how he met your mother.
If things had happened differently, he would have taken over from Salfalor as commander-in-chief. Lothrobur was our second-best warrior, after Salfalor.
Is that when you left?
I became a mercenary in Eidoslane, until I met a dwarf who told me about a group of exiles living underground. Every dwarf needs kinsmen, so I made my way to Trovegold.
Tungdil took her hand and shook it vigorously.
Thank you, Sander. I can't tell you how much it means to know the names of my parents, although I wish they hadn't died because of me.
I wish they were alive to meet their famous son, she said sincerely. But you're not to blame for their deaths. The laws are at fault. Lothrobur and Yerdis loved each other. But she was promised to another against her will. The Freelings have done away with forced marriages. That's another reason why I like this realm.
Tungdil got to his feet.
Will you drink with me to my parents?
It would be an honor, replied the commander. They made their way to the nearest tavern and raised their tankards to Yerdis and Lothrobur. Sander seemed happy to talk about Tungdil's parents, for whom she had nothing but respect. Listening to her stories, Tungdil, who had no memory of his parents, felt an overwhelming urge to avenge their deaths. His hatred for Glaimbar was supplanted by hatred for a thirdling by the name of Salfalor. After a few tankards, he summoned the courage to ask Sander to help him with his axemanship.
I'll be the best warrior in the history of the Thirdlings, he decided. Salfalor will pay.
Perista, former realm of Leos Nudin. Girdlegard, late autumn, 6235th solar cycle. The Magus' distinguished guests were greeted by the magnificent architecture of the new Perista. Under Radario's supervision, the city had risen from the rubble, the ruined buildings restored to their former glory. A bright future lay ahead for the realm. By the time the last of the delegates reached Perista, the city had begun to resemble a military camp. Flags and banners fluttered above the streets and houses, marking the territory of the different kingdoms. To no one's surprise, Luitasil's banners were situated as far away as possible from the crests of the clans in Gandagar's entourage. The shops and hostels of Perista welcomed the visitors. For the first time since its destruction, the city was booming. Takings were up, and the streets and alleyways were full of men, elves, and dwarfs. But the tension was palpable. Everyone had heard about the conflict between the elves and the dwarfs, and no one could say for certain whether the old enemies would talk peacefully or go for each other's throats. A repetition of the incident in Jon Balsur would put paid to the Great Alliance, not to mention the Assembly. The other delegates were relying on the threat of the Magus' magic to bring order to the proceedings. When the appointed orbit dawned, the leaders of Girdlegard descended on the palace. The meeting was to be held in the conference chamber, where the Council of the Magi had met for the last time. There was no sign of the battle that had claimed the lives of Lot Ionan, Myra, Turga, and Sabora. The cracked flagstones and fallen pillars had been cleared away, and the gleaming copper dome and pristine marble testified to the skill of Perista's artisans. In the eastern corner of the chamber stood Lot Ionan, whom Nerdon had turned to stone. Waiting to greet the delegates was Narmora, dressed in an embroidered robe that matched her crimson headscarf and went perfectly with her eyes. Andakai stayed out of sight. By arriving last, she intended to underline her power and signal to the kings and queens of Girdlegard that she outranked them all.
"Scrubs up nicely, doesn't she, brother?"
boomed a voice that Narmora recognized instantly as belonging to Boindil. It seemed to be coming from somewhere behind the delegation from Weyern.
"It's nice to know she made an effort on our behalf."
As the last of the Weyernians entered the conference chamber, The dwarfs came into view. At the head of the procession was King Gandergar, flanked by the twins. Representatives from the four allied kingdoms made up the rest of the deputation. She welcomed the High King first.